Yemen, and the medical facilities that do remain are running short of fuel and other supplies. In local news, demolition crews used explosives yesterday to bring down the largest remaining chunk of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, pushing the steel trusses off the container ship Dali into the water. The demolition marks a major step forward in efforts to free the Dali, which has been pinned by debris since crashing into the Key Bridge in late March. The bridge collapse killed 6 construction workers, whose remains have been found and some recovered. Officials say they expect to refloat the Dali in the next few days, after which a group of tugboats will guide it to a nearby terminal. Multiple federal agencies are conducting investigations into the bridge collapse, and Baltimore City officials last month said they would take action to hold the ship's owner and other parties accountable. A bus carrying farm workers in central Florida overturned this morning, killing 8 people and injuring about 40 others. The bus collided with a truck north of Orlando and swerved off the road, ending up on its side. The workers were being transported to a nearby watermelon farm, which said it closed today, quote, out of respect to the losses and injuries endured early this morning, end quote. The Arizona Supreme Court delayed enforcement of that state's recently revived 1864 abortion ban, according to an order filed yesterday. The order allows for a 90-day stay after the current legislative session ends and clears the way for a possible appeal to the Supreme Court. Last month, the same Arizona court ruled that the law banning virtually all abortions in the state could go into effect. The law says doctors or others who perform an abortion can be prosecuted unless the mother's life is in danger. The law does not include exceptions for rape or incest. Before yesterday's decision, the law could have been enforced starting June 26th. With the enforcement delay, the state is instead operating under a 15-week ban on abortions passed in 2022 that does make exceptions for medical emergencies, but not for rape or incest. The Biden White House this morning announced large tariffs on a range of Chinese imports, framing the move as an attempt to protect the U.S. economy from, quote, unfair trade practices. The tariffs cover some steel and aluminum products, computer chips, electric vehicles, solar panels, batteries and related materials, and some medical products. Tariffs on electric vehicles will be particularly severe, rising to 100% this year. The White House defended the EV tariffs as needed for ensuring, quote, the future of the auto industry will be made in America by American workers. Solar cell tariffs will increase by 50%. The Chinese Foreign Ministry referred to the tariffs as bullying and said they, quote, will seriously affect the atmosphere of bilateral cooperation, end quote. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 67 degrees with light rain. In New York City, 72 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Sojourner Truth, thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we mark the Nakba, which means catastrophe. This year will mark 76 years since the 1948 forced removal of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in order to establish the State of Israel. Even according to UN reports, prior to the Nakba, Palestine was a multicultural and multi-ethnic society. In December of 1948, the United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 194, which called for the Palestinian right to return for property restitution and compensation. But this has not happened 76 years later. And indeed, it was an act of the United Nations itself that established the partition that displaced Palestinians from their land. According to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, more than 5 million Palestinian refugees are living throughout the Middle East. And now we are 7 months into the genocide in Gaza, where more than 35,000 Palestinians have been killed, including 14,000 children. Let us go now to a clip focusing on the impact of children in Gaza of the genocide.
There's no safe place. The situation is very hard. There's no food, no drinks. Even the water is hard to get. My children cry and tell me, "Mother, we want a drink," and I don't know what to do. I'm like everyone else who left Rafah and came here. We are displaced here, but there's no safe place. The situation is very hard.
The clip you heard was from the Washington Post of a mother speaking from Deir al-Balah. This is after fleeing Rafah. And our guest today, we will be speaking with Ziad Abbas, who is the executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance, and Mlana, a Palestinian refugee living in Shatir refugee camp in Gaza. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines. Bombing is now, as we speak, raging in Rafah, the place that Israel had urged Palestinians to flee. And according to the CNN, 360,000 people thus far have fled Rafah. Now, what we're going to do at the start of the show, we are going to share a couple of clips with you, short clips from the film that was put together by Al Jazeera called Al-Nakba. It is a classic film. If you haven't seen it, I suggest you do. But we're now going to go to a couple of clips just as giving us some background of the history of the Nakba. Let's go to those clips now.
Though the UN had declared that Jerusalem should be an international zone, there was no reaction when the Israelis occupied 85% of the area of Jerusalem outside the walls of the old city. However, Israel expelled over 30,000 Palestinians from the neighborhoods in what is now known as West Jerusalem. Israel continued its expansion. Air raids, incursions, and expulsions escalated. By December 1948, the number of Palestinian refugees soared to over 700,000. The United Nations General Assembly responded by adopting Resolution 194. This states that refugees who want to return to their homes and live in peace with their neighbors should be given the right to do so as soon as possible.
Israel is a child of the United Nations, and it is determined to remain loyal to its parent body. It's going to base its whole policy upon loyalty to the United Nations. But it is up to the United Nations to be loyal to its child.
All the United Nations resolutions have been left in abeyance. They haven't been applied. And that, of course, is in good measure due to the United States.
The Israeli invasion and the expulsion of the Palestinians continued through 1949. By April 1949, the gravity of the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe, became very clear. Almost 500 towns and villages were destroyed. 11 cities and 100 other villages that remained intact were colonized. More than 13,000 Palestinians were killed and more than 30,000 injured. At least 850,000 Palestinians were expelled, representing 85% of the population living in the area that had been declared to constitute the State of Israel. In 1949, the UN strove to conclude separated truce deals between Israel and each of the surrounding Arab countries. These agreements were drafted with the intention of protecting the State of Israel against any future attack. The Israeli state split the remaining 22% of the land of Palestine into two separate parts. The eastern portion officially became part of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan in April 1950 and was named the West Bank. The narrow coastal band in the south came under Egyptian administration and was named the Gaza Strip. The word Palestine was erased from history, politics, and economics. The Institute for Palestinian Studies has recently documented the names and histories of all the devastated Palestinian villages that the third generation of refugees still refer to as their homes. In 1969, the former Israeli Prime Minister, Golda Meir, told the British newspaper The Sunday Times, "It was not as though there was a Palestinian people in Palestine that saw itself as a Palestinian people, and we came and threw them out and took their country away from them. They did not exist."
I'm from those who learned in the school that people with no land looked for a land with no people. So these people of here, what we call Palestine, maybe they were here, but they were no people. That's to say that 1,300,000 of people that were present here in 48 are either no people or were not here, and this was a kind of a mistake. And the 553 Palestinian villages that were totally destructed by the Israeli army didn't have any population, because no one until this very day changed this version of people without a territory. We're looking for a territory without people.
All righty, and those clips were from the film called Al-Nakba. What I'd like to do now is to welcome our first guest, Ziad Abbas, who's the executive director of the of Mecca, the Middle East Children's Alliance. He is a Palestinian, a refugee himself from a camp, a refugee camp in the West Bank. And Ziad has been with us before when we've tried to get the word out about what is happening in Gaza, specifically the impact of children, but just generally the situation on the ground. So Ziad Abbas, welcome back to Sojourner Truth.
Thank you, Margaret, for having me.
Okay, so Ziad, we heard the clips. I know you know this history of the Nakba and how it basically began, and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians being forced from their villages and denied the right to return. Ziad, just tell us a little bit about what you know about that history, its impact, how many that you know have been displaced, and where are Palestinian refugees now, Ziad Abbas?
Yeah, actually, we are, as Palestinian refugees, we are living this in our daily life. It's every day for us. It's ongoing. Nakba never stopped. As a matter of fact, right now we are experiencing another scale of ethnic cleansing, and now we have a genocide. And what happened in 1948 and even before 1947 and 1948, where we over 750,000 Palestinians already uprooted from 531 destroyed villages. And in 1948, and the number of Palestinian refugees right now, it's getting close to almost to 8 million Palestinian refugees all over the world, inside Palestine, in West Bank, Gaza Strip, in West Bank, East Jerusalem. Even in 1948, Israeli citizen, where they have Israeli citizenship. And of course, the majority of the people living in Gaza Strip, they are refugees. And most of them, they are living in 8 refugee camps. I'm sure Omlana, she's one of them, our she's joining us in this interview, she can explain about that. But for us, these numbers, it's growing up, it's changing. But as a matter of fact, right now, for Palestinian refugees, it's for 76 years. This never like acknowledged from the world and acknowledged in the way, in a practical way. There were many resolutions in the United Nations. You mentioned in your program 194, and there are many other resolutions about right of return and compensation for Palestinian refugees. So this is impacting every refugee, everyone living in a refugee camp. And right now we are experiencing the ongoing genocide in Gaza Strip since October 7th. But sometimes for us as Palestinians, psychologically, we live like what we call it, like the genocide, we call it slow genocide. And later on, it's like speed genocide. Like in, since October 7th until now, they speed the genocide, the Israeli occupation. But for us, like if we go back to 1948, what happened, over 15,000 Palestinians killed in that period. Over 17 massacres that was happened. And right now in Gaza Strip, this massacre is happening every night. And the total number of the people they are killed, estimation according to the Palestinian statistics right now, it's reaching like 140,000 Palestinians killed since 1948 until now in different stages. Only in last 7 months, almost and a half, let us say, 7 months and a half, we have over 35,000 killed in Gaza since October 7th. And add to that, over 10,000 people still missing under the rebels of the destroyed homes. And these numbers, it's impacting every Palestinian. I will say it in very clear and an honest way. We Palestinians right now, all over the world, part of us destroyed. Doesn't mean we are collapsing, giving up. No. But watching our people killed every day, watching our children, our villages, towns, people living in tents, people in hospitals, the discovery of mass graves in Gaza Strip. This is impact every Palestinian everywhere. And of course, our allies and everyone cares about a human being and human lives. But we as Palestinian, we believe in that for 76 years. Palestinian people never give up. They continue their struggle and simply just they want to be free and return back to their own villages. All of us refugees, we still have the keys of our destroyed houses. I still have the key of my family destroyed house in my village back home, Zakaria and the Jerash villages near Jerusalem. And most of the Palestinian refugees, they still have. These numbers is growing up as refugees. And just to make this kind of comparison, to make it clear, according to the Palestinian statistics, right now, we Palestinian people, we are 14.5 million people all over the world, inside Palestine and outside Palestine. And this number is like, you speak 8 million Palestinian, almost 8 million. The majority of the Palestinian people, we are refugees, including right now inside Israel itself. You have 1.75 million people like living inside Israel. And they are Palestinian, some of them Palestinian refugees. And for the first time, like in the since 1948, it's coming right now, the majority of the people living in Palestine, historic Palestine right now, they are Palestinian. We are more than the Israelis inside Palestine. But the majority of the Palestinian people, they are refugees actually living in the diaspora. So after 76 years, we are experiencing this ongoing genocide, and who knows, it's hard to predict what will happen, but what's going on every day, more Palestinian lives in Gaza Strip killed by the Israelis, ongoing genocide, and this is the time for us, just we want to remind the world we are here and we want to return back to our homes.
Absolutely. And Ziad, the numbers that you gave are so staggering. And I know actually sometimes when we're, you know, researching and looking at the media, even the UN numbers don't necessarily reflect the reality of what's on the ground. So I just wanted you to review those numbers again, just to underscore them. I think you said thus far, I mean, since the Nakba, 147 Palestinians have been killed, right? And then you also gave the numbers of The numbers killed now in this most recent genocide since October 7th, and how many missing? Could you give the numbers killed? And
the number of the people that are like killed inside Gaza since October 7th, it's over 35,000. Actually, 35,091, according to the last report, came from the Gaza Strip today. And we have other 10,000 people reported missing, and they are missing, and they are under the rebels of the destroyed homes since October 7th. And some of them, even their bodies under these buildings since almost November until now. And this is something as a fact. So you speak about over 45,000 already killed in Gaza. And of course, you speak about almost 79,000 Palestinians. They are already injured. Among them, 11,000 people, they need immediate treatment outside of Gaza because most of Gaza hospitals, actually by today, no fuel. That's why they don't allow. After they closed Rafah cross borders, no fuel inside Gaza. All Gaza hospitals will be out of service totally. Of course, Israel destroyed most of these, actually 36 hospitals destroyed by the Israelis. And 11,000, they need the treatment outside of Gaza right now among the people they are injured.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that, Ziad. Ziad will be staying with us for the rest of the hour. But now I would like to welcome Mlana, who is a Palestinian refugee living in Shatia refugee camp in Gaza. Lana, so glad you were able to get online to be able to join us. Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Margaret.
Okay, Lana, one of the things that we hope you will share with us is, first of all, the situation where you are now in Shatia. And also, we have heard that the majority of those killed thus far in Gaza, in fact, have been women and children. So just tell us about that. And also, anything you want to share with us about the situation of women and children where you are in Shatia refugee camp. Mlana.
Thank you again for having me. I'd like to start by saying that I am also a mother on top of everything else. And the most important thing, I am a mother and who is in constant fear of losing my family. When the war was waged on October 7th, everything in our lives changed. Everything was destroyed. And if you look at the destruction that is in Gaza Strip, and in the north of Gaza in specific, you would not believe that it was done by men. You would actually think that it's a Hollywood movie. Someone who has a vast imagination and imagined all of this destruction and put it on a screen. But it's very real. I'm living in the Shatik camp in Gaza City, in the north of Gaza. When this started and the land invasion of Israel started, we were ordered and we were told to move to the south of Gaza. We were, you know, from the very few families that decided to stay in the north and not be afraid of the threats. Our journey of moving around and our journey of leaving our house I live in the west of Gaza near the sea. And Gaza is a very, very small place. I'm sure you have a map and you have seen how small it is. So in the beginning, when we were in the West, everyone around us from our extended families, their homes were destroyed. They were threatened. Everyone came to our house. Suddenly, at 2 weeks of the start of the war, we had around 40 people in our house taking refuge. When the aggression had started in the west, where my house is located in Shatik camp, everyone with the people who are staying with us, we moved to east of Gaza because that's how we were ordered. Even to evacuate to the east or go to the south, we refused the south. It was out of the question for us. So we went to the east. We stayed there for about 2 months while the west of Gaza was annihilated. And I am not kidding about that word, and I'm not exaggerated. Annihilated. Nothing. Not a building, not a street. Nothing remained. My house had so many bombs inside it that we had to just to close the walls. We built them again so we just could stay, you know, inside the house without being seen. So we went to the east, and when they started invading the east, we were told to move back to the west. And the day we left the east, it was so sudden. Bombs were thrown into the houses that we were staying in. And we were running in the streets. I was holding my kids, my three children, my three girls, and so many other countless women like me, holding their children and running in the streets, running for their lives while the bombs were shot from over our heads. I honestly believe that day I am going to die, that there was nothing more scary that I've ever seen. So we were running in the street, and we moved back to the west, but not to our house, because the area where my house was, there was still invaded. There were Israelis in there. There were army in there. So we stayed in the Shifa hospital area. I'm sure you know what happened in the Shifa. We stayed there, and it was not long before the Shifa was invaded, and all of the buildings that are in the Shifa perimeters were destroyed, and we were running again for our lives. Like, when the Shifa invasion ended and we were walking down that area, we could see human bones sticking out from the ground, believe it or not. And I'm not exaggerating. I have seen things that no woman has to see. Our children had seen things they should never, not a child in the world should have to see. You know, the hundreds and the thousands of children that are being killed, the pieces of a human flesh that were scattered in the street, the bodies that were covered and uncovered, the destruction, everything that you could imagine in a sick mind, it was here in our lives. We have been living it for more than 7.5 months. You know, recently, yeah, just like 2 days ago, the people in the north of Gaza, I am in Gaza City, in the north side of Gaza Strip, but there's a north to the Gaza City. My family, who thought it was safe for them to move back to their homes in the north, suddenly they had the threat, just a few hours, that we are going to start an operation in this area. They just threw that threat and started bombing and annihilating everything. My family was fleeing for their lives again, came to my house. You can imagine that in my building now, which is partially destroyed, we have more than 50 people or even 55 people, my husband's family and my own family and other families that we are hosting. You know, in the months of December and January and February, things got so bad. And even in March, things got so bad that we had nothing to eat. The starvation that was publicized was real. It was not made up. There were days that my husband and I would not have breakfast so our children could eat our share. We would go on for days without eating anything so our children could eat. If I could show you pictures of my girls back in the starvation, you would not believe that they're the same children that you are seeing now. There was no flour, which is the basic food that we use, that we eat here in Gaza. You know, the kilo of rice that would normally cost like $2.50, $3, $4 tops, it scaled up to like $60 or $70. Nobody has that amount of money. We have been unemployed for over 7.5 months. People had exhausted all of their savings. We were not, the food was very, very scarce, that's for sure. And people didn't have the money to even buy something to eat. There were days that I had to eat mahalabiya, which is something made of cornstarch and water, so we could survive. And we survived on it for days. And this has gone on until the end of Ramadan. after Ramadan, things are starting to get better, but still the starvation is real and we have suffered through it. I have seen family and friends losing their homes, losing their children. I have seen my own extended family. We have around 150 people killed in it. My husband's extended family, more than 150 killed in it. Women and children, children who had been just months old. Everything you are seeing on TV channels like Al Jazeera and other channels, it is real. It's not made up. And I am an eyewitness. I am telling you what I have seen. I am telling you what I have experienced.
I'm sure for many who are listening right now, it is just unimaginable what you are going through, what your children are going through, what the people of Gaza are going through right now. I just remember being in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina, when the city was underwater, and running into bodies, you know, on the street and the building where hundreds of bodies were stored, and just the sight of those bodies on the street and then the stench coming from that was just absolutely unbearable. And I can't imagine, multiplied thousands of times, with what you all are living through in Gaza right now. Amlana will be staying with us for the rest of the hour. I'm joined by Ziad Abbas with the Middle East Children's Alliance. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're doing a one-hour special marking the Nakba. It has been 75 years now, about 76 years this year, since Palestinians, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, forcibly removed from their homes for the establishment of the State of Israel. And the UN resolution that was passed for the right to return and for restitution, property restitution and compensation, UN Assembly Resolution 194, has never been passed. And the United States military basically funding this genocide. We're going to take a very short station break. And when we return, we will stay with Ziad Abbas and also with Umlana speaking with us from Gaza. And so stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll also be talking about the movements, including the student movements that are breaking out across the U.S. and across the world. And it's what that means for people who are living through hell, really, which is happening now for the people living in Gaza. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Songs.
And the song you just heard was Bob Marley's Redemption Song. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California. We also want to welcome all of our listeners across the Pacifica Network, our flagship, as well as Pacifica stations. If you miss any part of this hour from 10 this morning, you can go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. We are also heard 24/7 nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners, all of those students across the United States that are in encampments happening right now, or who have been thrown out of encampments. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to all of our listeners across the Palestinian diaspora. And our guest today, Ziad Abbas, with the executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance, and also Ulana, who is a Palestinian refugee, speaking to us from Gaza. And what I'd like to do now is, again, going earlier in the show, I talked about how much the billions of dollars, to the tune of something like $287 billion, and that's a small estimate, that's not everything, that the United States has sent to Israel in military and other aid between 1946 and 2013. Now you hear the Biden administration talking about holding up a particular shipment, but at the same time, they're continuing to send weapons, so we can't be fooled by that. What I'd like to do now, though, is go to a clip from the University of Chicago, where an encampment was broken up brutally by the police. And this is a clip from the local Fox News station. Let's go to that clip now.
On the inside, what had happened, describe what happened in the quadrangle this morning.
Yeah, it was horrific. They waited like cowards until every single student was asleep in their tent, basically. And then they stormed in, maybe 40 or 50 of them with riot gear, screaming. They started throwing wood planks, throwing chairs, throwing absolutely everything in any direction to destroy the camp as fast as possible, to suppress this movement as fast as possible. And in fact, one of the chairs that they threw came within maybe 3 inches of hitting my girlfriend in the head. And they had just woken us up.
Oh, it was dark. It was before sunrise. They were coming, but they did for a while.
We had to worry. Oh, we had to worry.
So what did you do when all that action was happening?
I tried to make sure everyone was safe. I mean, it was chaos. It was terrifying. Yeah.
So you were able to get out. I understand that students are being threatened with disciplinary reaction for being in there.
They gave us some ridiculous notice out here saying that participants in the quad encampment, which no longer exists thanks to them, are facing an interim leave of absence as well as a criminal trespass charge. I have no idea if that's just a scare tactic or if it's real, but it doesn't matter, because the difference between us and people like these cops is that there are limits to when we continue following orders. And when you're talking about a genocide visited upon a colonized population of 2 million people trapped in a ghetto that's as long as a marathon and 6 miles wide, when that ghetto is being systematically starved, slaughtered, every hospital bombed, every university bombed, 70% of homes destroyed, 40,000 people murdered, 15,000 children murdered, the entire population on the brink of starvation, we say, and if our government and our academic institutions are complicit in this, there comes a point where we say we're not following orders, and it doesn't matter what you do to us, because there are principles and there are human lives that matter more than our careers and our futures. And that's what separates us from people like Paul Olivisantos, the coward president of this university, and these coward cops that come in terrorizing an encampment while people are sleeping.
Sitting in the fight, linked arm in arm with other protesters. What is happening here?
What's happening here? You'd have to ask them. Apparently, they're trying to intimidate us, trying to suppress the protest that is continuing to grow. I think that they thought they could basically terrify us into inaction, into flight, But this is what this university has never understood, has never accepted, has never reckoned with about this student movement, like, and not just at Chicago, but around the country, is that the commitment to Gaza runs deeper than fears for our safety, fears for our careers, fears for our paychecks. It is a fundamental obligation we have as citizens of a country that is presiding over this genocide, performing this genocide, and as students at a university that is invested in those same weapons manufacturers and that is partnered with the same apartheid institutions that train that military and develop its technology. Yeah, I've been talking to them this whole time. I've been asking them what it would take for them to stop following orders. I would ask them, you know, how many kids have to die? So if you say 15,000 kids are killed, they're still willing to violently suppress a national movement, raising the alarm that this needs to stop, that U.S. complicity needs to stop. So what if it was 50,000 kids, 200,000 kids, a million kids? What if the whole Gaza ghetto?
Next steps
for them? For me, the next step is a simple one, whatever form it takes, which is to continue fighting with every breath we have, with everything we have, for the people of Gaza, because the blood of those kids is on our hands. It's on all of our hands, whether we like it or not. If we're U.S. citizens or UChicago students, we are implicated in this horror that is being visited. It's total impunity because of U.S. Security Council vetoes by the state of Israel. I'm a student. Yes, I'm a PhD student. Again, I don't care. It doesn't matter. There are things that matter more than my academic future. And certainly every one of those children that is being murdered, starved, maimed, whose parents are having to choose, you know, do I let this kid starve first or that one? This is such an ugly reality of such great magnitude. And to even think, to really entertain questions about, like, oh, what might happen if Paul puts me on a leave of absence is ridiculous. And it's insulting to the memory of every child that has been murdered in the course of this genocide, with the full complicity of the United States, of Joe Biden, and of people like Paulo Bisantos and his cops. They six on us in the middle of the ground. They're hypocrites, they're cowards, and the blood of Gaza's kids is on their hands, too. The difference between them and us is that we know that and we reckon with it because we have a duty to them. Well, they hide from the truth. They won't even admit that a single university has been bombed.
All righty. And words there from a young man, a graduate student at the University of Chicago in the United States that participated in the occupation. They're brutally broken up by the police. And actually, Ziad, let's start with you here because we know we've heard what happened at Columbia University in New York where, you know, the New York police were brought in and brutalized students there to break that encampment up. And that move backfired really because then all these encampments sprung up at universities large and small across the United States and now across the world in Ireland and the UK and you know, Holland and various other countries. Ziad, just your comments on this, because you heard the young man talk about how those of us in the United States really have blood on our hands because of it's our taxpayer dollars basically that are funding this genocide. How important do you think this this movement is of students and protesters around the world? You know, how are you as a Palestinian and people that you know of responding and reacting to seeing these kinds of protests? Ziad Abbas.
Yes, actually, in your program, I'm listening to Omlana, and at the same time, I'm listening to the student, what they are saying, and you see the connection, the strong connection, even they don't know each other. Omlana and Gaza and 2.3 million people living in Gaza Strip, living this ongoing genocide. And at the same time, with the details she explained, and by the way, I am in touch with the Omlana family and following them. We are friends for a while. And yeah, I imagine listening to her voice on the radio with me here in this program. And I remember all these kind of calls with her family and her husband. And while they are moving from area to area, And every call, it can be the last call between us. But right now, listening to the students, witnessing what's going on, and this is take us back a little bit, how Gaza exposed the world. I mean, exposed all governments, United Nations, international organizations, the value of the human being, exposed to how they are looking at the Palestinian killed, Palestinian children, etc., and show that the double standards, the hypocrisy of all these governments and United Nations, what they are, who's controlling, and undermine the value of the human being in Gaza Strip. At the same time, listening to the student in Chicago and many other, all these students' movement, unions, organization, groups, all over United States, all over the world, you see Gaza, how much is influencing and wake up the world. This is unbelievable moment. This is the hope that we have. Between the resilience of Omlana voice, how she speaks and how she still try to protect her children and to survive and to stay where they are inside Gaza, but, and listening to the students and witnessing what's going on, this is give us hope as a human, a humanity, actually, not just for Palestinian, for every human being, for everyone is struggling for social justice in the world. This is keep our hope toward achieving something and change this world where every human being life is equal. We don't undermine or discriminate about it. And this is very important for us as a human being to keep this hope between what the people, I give the credit to the people of Gaza. They are the people they are right now changing this world. Sometime in some countries changing fast, sometime it's slow, like in the United States. But we can see this students' movement, and it reminds us, students' movement all the time reminds us what happened in the history, and students' movement behind changing a lot in this world, systems, organizations, etc. And it's coming back, and the momentum is still very strong, and we are very hopeful that this movement will lead to stop the genocide. Right now, the most important for us is to stop this genocide. And each one of us, I'm speaking here about myself and every all the listeners listening to your program right now in this minute, we should ask ourselves, what are we doing to stop this genocide? All of us responsible. If you are taking an action, that's great. And we need to continue taking action because our action maybe will save lives in Gaza. If we are ignoring it, silent is you are participating in the in this crime. It's a historical crime happening right now in Gaza. It's our responsibility. It's the people's responsibility. It's the workers' responsibility, the students' responsibility, everyone, all the communities. It's our responsibility right now to take an action and to stop this genocide, because every hour, actually, every 10 minutes, there is a child killed in Gaza. This is some of the statistics coming like from Gaza. Every 10 minutes, there is a child killed inside Gaza Strip. And we are responsible about that. And we need to continue what we are doing and to take more responsibility in the ground to stop this genocide. I want to give a salute to the students' movement for what they are standing for, human rights, for democracy, for and value the human lives. And they stand against genocide. There is their voices, assembly, and they continue to do that. And this is something give us a hope. And I saw many letters coming from Gaza to the students' movement. It was published in the media. It means a lot. And maybe Omlana can speak about this more than me because she's living inside Gaza.
Right. And Omlana, indeed, we are going to turn to you right now, wondering if you are getting news about the student movement and also all the other protests that have been going on around the world and the kind of, you know, reaction there on the ground. We know the bombing is still going on. The starvation is still going on. But how important for people who are listening right now, how important are these protests to those of you who are living this horror day in and day out, Omlana?
Well, to be honest, Margaret, it's a hope hopeful lifeline. We are hoping every day when we're seeing the news, seeing the protests in American universities and European universities, we're saying to ourselves, now there is a global movement. Israel has got to stop. Those people have got to affect their governments so they can affect Israel's policies and the war they're raging on us. Every time we're looking at them, seeing how they're standing up for us, people that we do not know, people from different nationalities, people from different religions, people that they do not necessarily ever known us or heard of us, but what they're seeing in the news is inhumane. No human can bear what they see on the news. Not, you know, what's happening in Gaza is shaking the world, is changing policies, is exposing Israel, exposing the world, exposing everyone who's given Israel the green light to start this war on us. So we are so happy that people are finally opening their eyes, and this movement has, you know, it's like fire. It's spreading like fire, honestly. And we are amazed how brave and courageous those young men and women are to stand up for us. It means a lot. And I'm honestly telling you, it's a lifeline. It's given us hope every day that things are about to change. The world is changing. And what's happening in Gaza is not going to go on forever. It's going to stop very soon. Those people are, you know, working so hard. They're protesting so hard for us. So, you know, someone has got to listen. Someone has got to hear them and do something about it.
Right. Thank you for that, Umrah. And this is a question to for either one of you, Ziad or Umlana. Are you hearing anything about any calls for ceasefire, for peace going on within Israel itself? And Ziad, you talked about the numbers, actually, of Palestinians, Palestinian people who are living in what is now considered Israel, Palestinian land now considered Israel. Are you hearing anything about that? And also, Ziad, we're very focused on Gaza, but we also know that there have been atrocities, attacks, and killings going on in the West Bank as well. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, first of all, according to the voices calling for ceasefire, yeah, there are a lot of protests inside Israel, but it's internal. But if you go back to the statistics coming from the Israeli community, and inside Israel, 65% of the Israel, they are supporting actually what's going on in Gaza. When they call for ceasefire, not because they care a lot about Palestinians, they are killed in Gaza. They care a lot about their own people and care about the hostages they are inside Gaza. It's not, and this is the irony. Israelis, I'm saying the majority of the Israelis, they are, you have the Israeli government, you have the Israeli army, you have the settlers, they are all over. And actually, this morning, how settlers, they attacked one of the aid convoy that tried to pass through West Bank and Hebron area, and they destroyed part of the trucks, actually, the settlers. What I want to say that the Israelis in general, they are not calling for ceasefire because they care about Palestinian lives. They are caring about the internal issue. It's happening inside Israel, and they want to stop and to have a ceasefire and to do the exchange of prisoners so they can release the hostages from inside Gaza. And this is the sad part, to be honest with you. The other thing is for the listening to the, sorry, I missed the other question, the second one.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I think you covered it, Ziad, actually. And Umlana, we have a few minutes left. I want to give both you and Ziad a chance to give some final thoughts. And Ziad, as we're waiting to speak with you again, we're going to want to find out your suggestions about how people can get in touch with the Middle East Children's Alliance and what you're asking people to do. Umlana, just in the few minutes we have left, some final thoughts from you. And can you quickly also tell us how are the children managing? Like, you know, I can't imagine being a mom and being a caregiver in that kind of situation, and where everybody just about is suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Just some final thoughts and a word about how the children are, Umlana.
Yes, the children, mine, I could speak about my children and the other children that are living with me in my building. They are truly scared. They have been moments with my own children. My youngest daughter, she's in second grade, or at least at the beginning of this year, this school year that is about to end. I was, to be honest, I was really, really scared because the bombings were so heavy. The airstrikes were so heavy. And I was holding her really, really tight. And I was telling her, I want you to stay in my arms, because if we're going to die, I want to die with you. We want to die together. She said, Mom, I don't want to die. I'm still in second grade. I want to be in third grade next year. If you want to die, you can die alone.
Can you
imagine having this conversation with an 8-year-old? Or back then she was 7-year-old. My middle daughter, she was 10, and she was getting sick and more sick every day. She was not, you know, nighttime is not a happy time for me as a mom, because she'd be scared all the time. She doesn't want me to sleep, and she doesn't want to go to sleep. She just want to stay with me. We are trying to do everything in our power to keep them calm, but they are not calm. They're scared every single second because the bombings never stop. They're always scared. They have lost appetite for food. They have lost weight. They have lost interest in life. Nothing is interesting for them anymore. They miss school. They used to say, we don't want to go to school. We're sick of school. Now they miss school. They miss their friends. Many of their friends died. Many of their friends migrated to the South, and they may never see each other again. What we are living as adults is nothing compared to how they're feeling. They are really, really, really in a trauma that I hope it will end soon.
Oh, my goodness. Final thoughts from you, and what is it that our listeners can do? Ziad, how can they contact Middle East Children's Alliance?
Yeah, absolutely. I will not say that much. What Umlana said is the strongest thing. It's hard to say anything after her. For us, yeah, we as Middle East Children's Alliance, we are still working on the ground. We are still working in different parts of Gaza Strip. And people, they can reach out to us. We have our staff members inside Gaza Strip. We have our partners everywhere in Gaza, where they try to help and distribute aid, support the community, whatever it's possible there to support. And just want to remind the people that since May 5th, nothing entered Gaza. And the Umlana spoke about the mass starvation. It's happening again right now. It's coming back again in different parts of Gaza, and especially in the north of Gaza. People, they can reach out to our website, meccaforpeace.org, and they can learn about what's going on in Gaza. They can learn about what we are doing there, and they can support and stay in solidarity with people of Gaza. And thank you, Margaret, for the great program you are doing.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your work, Ziad. Terrific work there at the Middle East Children's Alliance. And Umlana, we hope to really follow your story and be in touch again and see how you, your children, and your community are doing. Thank you so very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you.
Right.
Glad to have been here. Thank you so much.
Okay, I'd like to thank all of today's guests. I also want to thank Payday Men's Network, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, for their help with today's show. I'd like to thank Jose Benavides for his help with today's show. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Please stay tuned for more programming on your local station. And be sure to listen up to catch Radio Free Palestine, 24 hours of programming on Pacifica Radio across our network nationally 24/7. So tune in to your local Pacifica or affiliate station. Thank you for listening. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air next Tuesday. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and you all please stay well and safe.